The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them. This is the episode for the 6th of September, 2013, in which we discuss how the expectations for engineers change with each new era. Okay. We'll clap on four so I can line these things up. One, two, three, four.
Gets me every time.
I should ask, are we clapping when you say four or on the fourth beat?
You clap when I say four.
See, I did it right that time.
I feel like we need to have a whole just talking session on how to clap. Yeah. Like, that should be next week. It's just us clapping in synchronicity.
All right.
I'm sure we could come up with a Python program to do this.
That would be the engineering solution to the problem.
Yes.
No, okay, some deep engineering humor coming
no,
up.
No, we need like a metronome on both sides. Beep, beep, boo.
But what if one of us is on a bullet train trying to record and then we have relativistic effects?
Oh, okay. Don't even get me started.
Oh.
I hate when I go relativistic.
It bugs me too.
Okay. Carmen, are you ready for your question?
Sure.
All right. I'll wait about five and then I'll ask. So, Carmen, did your engineering education ever delve into topics like noticing and listening and questioning?
Well, actually, I took a three-course sequence on just those exact topics.
No kidding.
Yes, I am kidding. And I can't say my education ever called out those three topics by name, but maybe in some of my grad classes that are a little more open-ended, they talked about those topics and, you know, mentioned how things are important. And maybe in some of my lab classes, those were brought up, but never explicitly. I never had a full day's lecture devoted to those topics.
Yeah. And so in the workplace, do you find those are important skills?
Yes, exactly. Very much so, especially the questioning, because whenever someone has a problem, they never tell you exactly what's wrong in the first email. So yeah. You have to read between the lines and ask another question, because if you don't, you'll go to the lab, take measurements, and find out you had to change a parameter that you had just assumed you could set at 12 volts or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And then you got to redo all your work.
Yeah. And in special machinery, I always found it important to control expectations, and part of that was making sure that assumptions that weren't made. You know, you'd have a discussion, and the assumption would be that just because they said the machine would run fast, it would run at some speed they had never mentioned, or the cost would be under some unnamed figure. And so you're absolutely right. There, you have to listen to hear what is being expected and question, determine what the intent is on the other side.
Yeah, exactly. Another example I can think of is, you know, there's always a back and forth between the designers and the applications engineers. And the designers will say, here's the list of bugs you guys generated from your bench testing. Which ones do you want fixed? And the answer is always, well, all of them would be nice.
right.
But, you know, you have to make certain trade-offs if you want to get the chip out on time. And if you know you're going to get an extra vision of silicon, maybe not all, you know, 20 items on your list are critical. Maybe only three of them are.
Mm-hmm.
So that plays a big part into the listening and questioning.
Yeah, well, I think that we're in agreement here that those are important skills that just that don't normally get taught in the engineering curriculum.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And so this evening, we have a guest who can address that because he's been working hard to get those issues incorporated into engineering education.
That's a little coincidence. It's like we plan these guests out ahead of time.
You would think that, huh?
Yeah.
Well, our guest this evening is David E. Goldberg, who was a PhD in civil engineering, and he did much of his academic work, interestingly enough, in genetic algorithms. Well, I have to ask him how he got from civil engineering to genetic algorithms.
Yeah, it's not exactly something you'd expect.
No. And up through 2010, which is not that long ago, he was a professor at the University of Illinois. He was specifically the Jerry S. Dobrovolny Professor of Entrepreneurial Engineering. And late in that year, 2010, he resigned his tenure and took up his current role as president of Three Joy Associates, which advises educational institutions on how they might reform and transform their instructional programs. Dave, welcome to the Engineering Commons.
It's great to be here with all of you.
Great to have you on.
And so I know that this evening you're on the road, but you're in Boilerville. You're in West Lafayette, Indiana this evening.
Yeah, I'm in the home of Purdue University in West Lafayette, and doing some transformational work down here with some of the folks at Purdue.
Well, having gotten two of my degrees from Purdue, you're at a fine institution.
Not that you're biased.
Not at all. Not at all. Go Boilers.
And don't tell my colleagues at Illinois that I'm here.
We'll be very, very quiet.
It's not like this is going on the internet or anything.
So our guest last week was, or last show was Alan Wolke, and we talked about amateur radio. And so I'm wondering, Dave, have you ever had any involvement with ham radio?
Yeah, I was, I got my ticket, when I was, 13, which was an awfully long time ago. And, my, call sign was and is, WA8VZC. And, I'm not active much anymore, but, I think I may have held claim to being one of the youngest radio teletype operators at the time.
Wow.
Quite the achievement.
Well, and I was reflecting on how cool it was to have that big honking Model 15 clacking away with something coming over from Europe or something. That was pretty cool for a 13-year-old.
And who were you running this teletype for, or were you doing this as this was part of your hobby?
This was part of my rig. So I was running high frequency radio teletype and frequency shift keying and had this surplus Model 15 that I don't know where we got it, but I remember. I think we bought it for $35 and hooked it up to the modem it was actually a homebrew modem hooked up to, shifting the VFO on my Heathkit transmitter. Mm-hmm. If I remember all this right, but it's been a while since I had that rig, but. Anyways, we're talking stuff from, 45 years ago or something. So this is, and a lot of my equipment back then was running vacuum tubes. Mm. This is sort of, pre-high power, transistors.
So what kind of traffic would you listen to? Was it primarily just amateur, or were you listening to, commercial journalism or diplomatic stuff?
No, it was amateur. It was two way. So I was sending and receiving to, I'm trying to remember if I was on, I operated a lot on 40 meters. But I'm trying to remember, cause I remember doing Europe and it wouldn't have been on 40. So it might've been 20 or 15, but I can't recall for sure. But anyways, yeah, I did that and I had, after the Heathkit, I got a used Swan 350 sideband transceiver, and I don't remember. At one point I had a 15 meter. My parents weren't too happy about it, but I had a 15 meter Yagi on top of the, not up too high, but high enough to get some good bounce. Anyways, yeah, it's a long time ago. And every once in a while, over the course of, it's about every 10 years or 15 years, I'd get the itch to do something. So I'd get some sort of rig and do some sort of something. But it's been a long time since it's probably been 10, 15 years since I did that.
Yeah. Well, now I'm going to guess that perhaps this interest in amateur radio might have had something to do with you're being directed towards engineering, but I would have thought electrical engineering and not civil engineering.
Yeah. So that's sort of an interesting story. So as a senior in high school, they had, a day where you sort of walked around with someone over in City Hall. And so I followed the city engineer around, who was a civil engineer. And we got talking about, what civil engineers did. And he said, well, you know, civil engineers a lot of times work in private practice and have their own companies. And I think that was attractive to me. And I think it was that that sort of got me off into enrolling in civil engineering. Because I think you're right. I would have gone into electrical, of course, in trying in, you know, in the early 70s, going into civil engineering to be in private practice misses the whole electrical engineering entrepreneurial revolution of the 70s. So I missed the boat in terms of, in some sense, in terms of owning my own business, but I don't regret the choice because it led to a number of things in my career that were kind of fun and interesting. But yeah, it was turned by that one day of working with that one engineer at City Hall.
Wow. That's quite an influence.
Yeah.
So now you get into engineering school, you majored in civil engineering, and you eventually get your doctorate in civil engineering. But as I understand it, a lot of your research was in genetic algorithms. How did you get from civil engineering to genetic algorithms?
Yeah, so I left school to take a job with a software firm with my master's, and it was a fairly small entrepreneurial startup. Actually, I was a lone engineer, and he had four computer programs and a new building in the middle of a cornfield in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and so I go join, and it was a great job, although I didn't really know what I had gotten myself into. My first day I walk in, he hands me these manuals and says, oh, a customer in Harrisburg needs your help. And, oh, by the way, on Monday you need to do a sales call in Chicago with our timesharing salesman. So anyways, it was just, I thought I was going to be doing all this Fortran coding of these fluid mechanics codes that I had been trained in my master for the care and feeding of them, and instead I'm doing all this
sales and
this
marketing,
kind of entrepreneur, yeah, sales, marketing, customer support, but you're in a small company, you do everything, and that was really cool, and then we started to work with doing real time modeling of gas pipelines, and I realized that these operators of gas, long distance gas pipelines, were driving the pipeline like you or I drive a car. And I thought, oh, that's cool. And then I was reading Doug Hofstadter's book that got a lot of people interested in artificial intelligence, Good, Lesher, and Bach. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Hey, why don't I go? And anyways, one thing led to another, and I decided to go back to school, and I decided to do artificial intelligence. And so I go back to Michigan to get my PhD, and I sign up for the artificial intelligence course the first day. Mm-hmm. And it was canceled.
Uh-oh.
So my hopes and dreams of doing artificial intelligence and gas pipelines is going down the tubes, and I sign up for a class called Introduction to Adaptive Systems by a guy named John Holland, who later was one of my thesis advisors. And he's talking about genetics and evolution. And I'm going, you know, so where's the artificial intelligence? But the more I listened to him, I said, oh, this is interesting. So one thing led to another, and I ended up, for my dissertation, applying genetic algorithms to gas pipeline optimization and control. And that sort of led to my doing that as my major research topic as a professor.
Wow. Now on your, there's a page on Wikipedia about you, and it lists you as a computer scientist. Does that bother you at all?
Oh, that's interesting. it's kind of a matter of, it's actually a source of pride because of when the work came along, and I wrote a book on genetic algorithms in 89, and that book is among the most cited texts in computer scientists. And so it was a source of permanent annoyance to my colleagues in computer science at Illinois that a civil engineer was one of the most cited computer scientists. So there's a certain sense of at Illinois. So it was a source of pride and so it doesn't bother me. And most of my PhD students were CS grads, and so actually it's kind of cool to have a career where you study one thing and you end up doing another and you're pretty good at it. So yeah, no, it doesn't annoy me, and I do wish that it would list me as a computer scientist and an engineer.
Okay, well,
we can solve that.
Perhaps
problem.
You can solve. Yeah, so somebody needs. So I don't like to go in and fix my own page, and I'm not sure who put that page in there originally. Anyway, so probably some eager students.
Right. So now you're a tenured professor at the University of Illinois. You've got research students. You're making progress. I note that you've written several books along the way about engineering education, so you're getting a chance to at least, you know, share your thoughts about that as you go along.
Yeah.
And then comes 2010, and you decide you're going to make radical changes in your career. What did you do, and why did you do it?
Yeah, so there was a sequence of events that started in about 2006, including starting a set of workshops on philosophy and engineering, starting something at Illinois called the Illinois Foundry for Innovation and Engineering Education that started to have an effect and on transforming engineering education at Illinois. And those efforts were starting to pay off in a way that I thought I could take around the world and help others do the same thing. And so at about 2010, I was thinking, well, you know, maybe I'm getting on in my career. Maybe it's time to go become a dean or a department head or go do something else. And I hired, to help me figure this out, I hired an executive coach to sort of ask me questions and help me reflect on this. And she asked me some really killer questions that got me to realize that what I was doing with iFoundry and educational transformation was pretty special, and that maybe I ought to go off and start a company and help others. And then part of my learning from the experience of being coached was to take training as an executive coach at Georgetown University. And that was, in some sense, maybe the single most personally transformative experience of my life. And so it kind of put me, the being coached and taking training as a coach kind of put me in a different part of the of my personal phase space. And so I, you know, here I am, and I'm off, you know, wandering around the world helping people figure out what the next generation of engineering education should be.
Yeah, that's got to be just a huge jump to go from the world of engineering academics, where it's all, you know, papers and equations and what have you published, to openly sharing feelings and trying to get others to open up and to identify what their emotional needs are.
Yeah, when you put it that way, it sounds like it, and yet the experience of it seems pretty natural, and the progression makes sense in a certain, you know, in the experience of it makes sense. There was never a point where, like, I had an out of body experience, or frontal lobotomy, or, you know, I never felt like that there was some sort of something wrong with me, but you're right. When you put it that way, it's a big shift in it. And yet it feels, when I talk to my former grad students about it, and about when I told them, oh, I'm taking training as a coach, they said, well, Dave, you did that anyways with us. So there's a sense in which that role was always part of what I did as a as a professor. Mm-hmm. I just sort of maybe got a little training in it and sort of tuned it up a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's still a huge change. Are you happy with it so far? Has it been working out well for you?
Yeah, I love the work. I'm trying to count the number of careers, but sort of I had the working career as an engineer, and then I went off and got my doctorate, and then I worked as a professor for a long time, and this is maybe my third career. I don't I don't know. But anyways, I really loved all of them. I enjoyed working as an engineer immensely. Being a professor and writing and speaking and the things that I learned in that were really cool, and working with great graduate students was a blast. And I love this, what I'm doing. I think there are things different. You have different needs and different things that are important to you at different points in your life. And it feels like I've been blessed to, have something interesting come along in all three of the careers that was deeply fulfilling in all three cases.
Oh, fantastic.
Fantastic. Well, my career couldn't be that fulfilling. It's been going good so far.
Well, and you know, so it, and actually that's a lot of the work that I do with faculty or professionals is sort of at talking to them about, well, what is that, and you know, what is fulfilling work. And there's sort of two parts when you work with someone as a coach. There are usually two parts to the engagement. There's the first part where somebody comes to you and they say, hey, there's something out there and it's kind of getting in my way of my achieving what I want. And then you work with the person. And then what you end up finding out is that thing that was out there wasn't really out there. It was inside. There's some story that the person has that's sort of holding them back. It's not really external. It's internal. And then you clear that out, and there's like this, it's like when you clear that out and they feel the openness of what's possible, there's this kind of, it's a little scary because it's now, okay, all this is possible. So what do I do, and how do I do work that's aligned with who I am? And so then the exploration becomes trying to figure out who you are authentically and what it is that would be aligned with where you are right now. And so it's a blessing to be able to do that kind of work with people. And it's really cool when somebody sort of goes from some constraint that they thought that they, some box that they're in that they think there's no choice, to having choice, to then choosing cool stuff that they then do with their life. And I feel like I've felt the experience of that, and it's cool to be a witness and help others do that.
Do you see people leaving maybe a technical field they didn't like and going less technical, or going, you know, leaving perhaps a company that's dragging them down and going and doing something on their own?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say it's not, it varies. I've seen, I guess I'm trying to think in particulars of different clients and what, you know, what happens when they, sometimes this is like an unleashing. So what happens when they're unleashed from these constraints? I guess I've seen it different ways. I've seen, say, people who had a particular discipline sort of, the freeing, they stay in discipline, but now they change the circumstances. They thought that, you know, so a lot of times people are kind of stuck in a trap of seeking the appreciation of their colleagues or others. And so once that's thrown off, they can be the kind of engineer or designer they want to be. So I've seen that. I've seen people kind of change, you know, they thought that they had to do certain kind of work and they change direction. I can't say that I see a trend away from or, you know, into technical work or changed technical work. I don't know that there's any, I don't know that I have enough data to say anything about that, but it's just interesting to see what usually you find actually though better aligned, you know, people are better aligned with who they are and what they value, and the work that they now do and the way they do it, either for themselves and a company they start or changing employer or whatever it is somehow a better fit for them. And there's like a greater happiness that comes from that.
So you mentioned you got onto this path of coaching because you wanted to revolutionize engineering education. Guess you kind of have to ask, what did you want to change it from and what did you want to change it to?
Yeah, and so the origins of that work sort of started with iFoundry, and I have to confess that we didn't really, it sort of didn't start with the grand plan of from and to. It sort of started from humbler beginnings than that. So we were kind of, I was sitting around with a colleague back in, 2007, and we were working, we were doing what professors at the University of Illinois do. We were writing a proposal for research funding. And, but part of the proposal was about educational, the proposal had to have an educational component, and we were talking about innovation and creativity and so my colleague, Andreas Kangalaris, who, by the way, now is the dean of engineering at Illinois. At the time, he was an electrical engineering faculty member. And he jumps up and he says, well, we need to teach this stuff to our own kids. And I say, well, yeah. And he says, why don't we do that? I said, I don't know. And he says, well, I'm going to go talk to the dean. So he goes and talks to the dean about this. And he comes back all excited. He says, Dave, good news. The dean's going to appoint a committee, and he's going to have us help him write the charge to the committee. And I listened to this, and I got pissed off. I said, Andreas, I'm getting too old to be on another committee that writes a report and does nothing.
And you want to actually see some change for
us. And so we said, so we sort of parted ways for a while, and then kind of came back together, and we said, look, if you want to do a let's do what industry does. Let's create a pilot project that pilots change and see what's doable. I don't know what's doable. There's a lot of resistance to change, but let's try. And so that was the birth of iFoundry. We wrote a white paper. We talked about, we did an analysis of why it's so hard to change things. But a lot of our thinking wasn't about what, it was more about how. How, so you've got the system that's designed to resist change. How do you change a system like that was our starting point. And it wasn't like we didn't have ideas. There were many reports out at the time. The National Academy of Engineering had the Engineer of 2020 and Educating the Engineer of 2020. Jim Duderstadt, the former president of University of Michigan, had a report out. There were a lot of reports out saying that had the list of how the engineer of the future should be different. So we said, go read those lists, but like good engineers, we were saying, okay, so that's nice to have those lists, but if we can't figure out how to change this darn system, it's not going to go anywhere. So we figured that the bottleneck was the change process, and iFoundry as an incubator for programmatic change was our solution. And it kind of had two parts. Our analysis was that faculty don't change in academia. It's like a NIMBY problem in the siting of a nuclear power plant, not in my backyard. Everyone says, oh, reform is great. Just don't change my course.
Yeah. Their notes are perfect. They got them right on the first try.
Exactly. Well, and then they get used for the next 20 years. And I did some of that myself, and we all did it. But then once you get the initial NIMBY problem, then you've got a log rolling problem. So, oh, you vote not to change my course, and I'll vote not to change your course. So you have coalitions forming around conserving the status quo, and that's essentially what you get when you approach a faculty committee on curriculum to make a major change. And so we said, let's change the dynamics of that. Let's have a pilot. Let's promise to respect faculty governance. Nobody becomes a faculty member to sort of give up their voting rights, to have some centralized figure tell them what to do. So let's respect faculty governance. That's important to the community of scholars that is the academy. But then let's allow change to take place in pilot form. Then we'll have students, we'll have faculty involved, we'll have data, and then we'll come back. And if the changes are meaningful, the conditions during the vote will be different. So that was the basic idea that we had, was let's come up with a process that will allow us to pilot change successfully and then see how close we can get to these lists that people are generating.
So it's a pretty smart implementation, because if you don't have the students and the faculty on board, the whole thing kind of falls apart.
It just doesn't go anywhere. And so that's what we had seen. There were efforts in the 90s. National Science Foundation pumped millions of dollars into 7 or 8 engineering education coalitions. And the coalition, as long as their money was flowing, people were making the changes. When the money went away, the changes kind of reverted to form. And so there were, a lot of money was put into those efforts, a lot of time, a lot of good thinking too, and actually some effective change. But at the end of the day, it didn't really stick. And so we wanted something that was sort of self-funding, didn't require a lot of money, but a process that would allow schools to sort of update themselves in this way, in some sort of reasonable process.
So we're getting a little ahead of ourselves this evening in that we're identifying the way that engineering education needs to change, and I want to talk about that, but I want to talk a little bit about how we got there. And we've had a, through history, engineers have been part of society. We know that, you know, as far back as, you know, the Greek and Roman societies, the Greek Parthenon must have been built by engineers, and the aqueducts and the Roman Colosseum and the Roman roads had to be built by engineers. And that during the Middle Ages, you know, the spinning wheel and the mechanical clock and the printing press were invented. There were engineers during that period of time. But that we go for a long time and engineers worked in fairly great anonymity. And so we finally get up to the Industrial Revolution and you know, there's the first iron bridge and there's an improved steam engine. And we're starting to build a little momentum. And we get to sort of the golden age of, or the golden era of engineering, where we have these engineering heroes. And so one of the points that we wanted to discuss was the fact that what makes for a great engineer sort of depends upon the times or the time that that engineer finds themselves in. What makes for a great engineer in medieval times may not be what it takes to be a great engineer in 2013.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. You know, if you look at the 19th century, you look at the 1800s, and the beginning of the century, you've got the great works projects of the canals and then the railroads. And you look at, in many ways, there are a number of historians that attribute the creation of modern enterprise to the engineering of the railroads, because in some ways that was one of the first times where people had to cross long distances with schedules and with very tight tolerances. And the organization of the railroads wasn't there were no models to follow. And so the engineering of the organizational form of the railroads was done by the civil engineers that built the roads. And then late 1800s, you've got the emergence of electrical engineering, and the better understanding of electromagnetics through the practical efforts of Faraday and then Maxwell's equations. And so you've got this emergence of sort of almost, in some ways, corresponding like rock star electrical engineers to our, you know, to like internet entrepreneurs of our time, except the organizations that emerged from that technology became large and vertically integrated. And so that period of sort of rock stardom of electrical engineering in the late 1800s was sort of short-lived.
You've talked in the past about a golden age of engineering.
Yeah.
And sort of between the middle of the 1800s and the middle of the 1900s, a lot of those names came to the fore. You were talking about it in electricity.
Yeah.
Certainly the combination of Thomas Edison, who was working on a lot of that, and eventually started his own power company. Which part of it became General Electric, which is around yet today.
Yeah.
George Westinghouse, who decided that Edison was all wrong because Edison wanted DC power, and Westinghouse decided AC power would be the better way to go, and he started his own AC power company, which became Westinghouse Electric, which I don't know if that's around still today, except somebody I'm sure has bought the trade name.
Westinghouse is still a pretty big company.
Oh, are they? Okay. And at the same time, Nikola Tesla, who worked for both Edison and Westinghouse at various times, and perhaps was the smartest of the three of them, but ended up not making a penny over his lifetime. But you're absolutely right. During that generation, those engineers were not just engineers. They were the leading businessmen of their time, as well as you put it, they were the rock stars of their time.
Yeah, and it's interesting how there are different trajectories for the different types of engineering depending on the organizational structure that fit the industries that they were in. So, for example, in those times, the mining engineers were always captive to the mine owners. There's this term that Stephen Goldman at Lehigh University uses says that engineers are a socially captive or were a socially captive profession in much of the 20th century. But in a certain sense, the mining engineers were captive from the get-go. The civil engineers, on the other hand, had this tradition of small private practice, and so they were their own business owners, and they worked and served the interests of their clients in a way. The electrical engineers went from being rock stars to being captive as the large companies took over and sort of sucked them into their machinery. But it's interesting that it's not sort of the experience of engineers isn't uniform, and I'd say that's even the case today, that there are variations depending on the kind of work that an engineer does and the organizational structure that he or she works for.
For mining engineers, is that driven by the capital cost of their industry, or was it at the time?
There's sort of my source for that discussion is a book called a famous book by Edwin Layton called The Revolt of the Engineers, and I think that that it's attributed to it wasn't the technology that was the key, the invention of anything. It was sort of the capital owning the land rights and the mining rights, mineral rights, and having the mine was the key thing in the mining engineering. And so independent professionalism was not a high value in the organization of the mining engineers' professional societies, and instead some of the things that were written about for engineers in that industry were to be loyal to the mine owner and to management and so forth. And so the shape of our professional societies have always been shaped by the conditions of work of engineers at the time.
Right. So this generation of the rock star engineers,
yep,
sort of came to a halt in the mid 1900s.
Yeah.
I would say that probably we could use World War II as the cutoff. So what was it about the outcome of World War II that changed the way engineering was perceived and how engineers were treated and how engineering education was delivered?
Well, and I think you're right. World War II is a good alignment point to sort of take note of what the world's like at say just after the war, and look at it in terms of organizational. We'll look at it in terms of how information is treated, what work is like, and what what's the economic organization of different industries. And so, if you look at just post-war, what's information about? Well, information is hard to get. It's hard to synthesize, and if you get it, it's expensive. And it's work like? Well, work is, organizations are vertically integrated. I've got this postcard I use in one of my presentations of a 1947 picture of the Rouge plant in Dearborn, Michigan, and there's an ore freighter parked outside. Henry Ford was making his own steel. We talk now about sticking to your core competence, but nobody was sticking to core competence in 1947. You had the big vertical integration so the iron law of economics then was economy of scale, and the bigger the better, and integrated horizontally, vertically, that's the way you made money then. And then if you look at organizations, it's sort of, William White and the organization man. We sort of have men mainly trained in, all trained the same, dressed the same, looked the same. And it was, White's book, The Organization Man, was a critique of the uniformity of work life at the time. So that's then. But now look at where we are now and how different all three of those variables are. So look at information. Information's widely shared. It's cheap. It's easy to synthesize. What's work like? Well, you got some big companies. You still have some integrated companies, but they're integrated for different reasons. They're integrated because returns to network effects make products like Microsoft Word more valuable the more people that use them. But then most companies are sticking to their core competence and getting leaner and meaner. So the economics is no longer dominated by economics of scale. And then what's work like? Well, you got people playing pinball machines and having their laundry done and chefs cooking for them at Google. It's not, there's no row and row after of desk. It's more like a college campus to work in many engineering firms. So the world that we live in is very different. And a bunch of stuff happened in between. Some of that was the information. Much of that was technological and economic, the information technology revolution. Some of it was the way we finance companies, the entrepreneurial revolution. And some of it was about processes of work, the quality revolution. But you take those three things, that's a triple whammy that takes us from a world that doesn't look almost anything. It's almost upside down from the world that we had not all that many years ago in World War II to now. And yet we're sort of still training engineers with the consensus of the 40s and 50s.
Right. And you have written a paper about change in engineering, one myth, two scenarios, and three foci.
Yeah.
What was the myth?
What was the myth? Boy, I wrote that article in 1994. I'm trying to remember what the myth was.
The myth was that science saved the war, not engineering.
Yeah, thank you. Gosh, yeah, that's right. I think different people you can analyze what happened in the war. And I think the myth of the war was that it was stuff like the atom bomb and radar that won the war, and those were important. Those were important technological discoveries and scientific to a certain enabled by science. But I mean, when you deconstruct those and you say, okay, well, let's really look at the atom bomb. All right. So the basic science of the atom bomb was made possible by breakthroughs in physics. But there was a heck of a lot of engineering that, you look at the plutonium bomb and the way the charges had to be shot off in order to cause it to go critical. Regardless of just viewing it from the standpoint of getting the darn thing to work, that was an engineering achievement as much as it was a scientific achievement. But yet somehow there's something in the narrative that sort of gives the physicists the credit. Same thing with, you look at other things that helped win the war. Well, where's the amazement at the kind of technological and manufacturing prowess that allows us to make a gazillion Liberty ships and the P-51 Mustang together in 105 days? So there's this sort of biased telling of the story of World War II that sort of gives the credit to physics. And I think there's a sense of physics envy that then engineering, especially academic engineers, have thereafter, that somehow they've been shown up by the physicists, and we've got to sort of play that game. And then post-war, there's this sense there are moves made to change the curriculum, take practical subjects like design out of the curriculum, inject more math science and engineering science into the curriculum, and make it more of an applied science degree than a practical engineering degree. There's a report in the States that was reflected in 54-55 in a report that's sometimes referred to as the Grinter report. That report sort of that essentially the curriculum that we now have in many ways can be traced to that time.
So if I was to go back to the late 1930s and look at engineering education at that time, in place of the advanced science and math, what would you have seen?
Yeah, great question. So I think first of all, you'd see people doing more engineering drawing and mm-hmm. of real engineering objects. You'd see shop classes. You'd see concern for making stuff and knowing how to make things and knowing about machining and how things are actually physically made.
So design for manufacturing?
Yeah, well, so there was a sense in which, it wouldn't have been called that then, and it was actually more about, manufacturing for manufacturing. It was sort of, okay, so how do you make stuff, and how do you represent things to be made? There was more a sense of artifact and of engineering artifact and the thing made as opposed to theory about the thing mm-hmm. made. Yeah.
So you might design something and know it works, but not have a full understanding of exactly why?
Yeah. So no, I don't think that, I don't know that that's fair to say. And it's not fair to say that there wasn't math and science and that if you we were just talking about the 1800s, there was terrific fascination with scientific achievement and the kinds of things that people were learning. And so engineers of that time were not there was never anti-scientific movement, or there was just a sense of wanting to understand and though knowing that engineering was about sort of having things be made practically and getting mm-hmm. things done in the world. I think at the
end of the day, something's got to roll off the assembly line.
Yeah. But I think you look in the 50s, there's a sense of, say, removing design classes from the curriculum. There's a sense of a lot of the shop and the practical stuff and a lot of the drawing got removed to make room for more advanced math science and engineering science that was that was the stuff that real engineers learned. Yeah.
I find it kind of interesting how, at least where I am, industry's requesting more of that hands-on,
yep.
How to draw things. And let's go back 50 years.
Yeah, no, I think there's many ways where what we're doing now is sort of back to the future. So get in that DeLorean and go back and much of what people are asking for now is a throwback to then. The department I joined at Illinois was a department of general engineering drawing, so it taught drawing, but then it had a general engineering curriculum, which was created in 1921 at the behest of Chicago area industrialists who wanted engineers who knew technical stuff, but even, they were complaining back in 1921 that they were too technical and that they wanted engineers who actually knew something about business in 1921. and the fact that so many engineers go on to get MBAs is sort of the modern instantiation of that kind of desire. But this the curriculum that evolved never became popular, but it was sort of responding to the sense that engineers were sort of both technologists and involved in commerce and business.
So as time goes forward, we're sort of, I think, coming to a point where the role of engineering again is going to shift a bit. As we went from the rock star era to the anonymity of the late 1900s, and it seems to me that with all these technological changes, as you talked about the communications, big data, internet, global competition, all that. So what do you see the role of engineering becoming as we look forward?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question to reflect on, and I think it's in our discourse. I think that it's almost become a commonplace to talk about the degree to which innovation is important. So people use the word innovation. You look
pretty
at,
big buzzword yeah, these days.
Good buzzword when you you look at the business writers. So Tom Friedman says the world is flat. Dan Pink says you need a whole new creative mind. Richard Florida says there's a rising creative class. So there's a, the word creativity is in the fore. If I were to say pick, I would say that if you look at the engineer of the 50s, the engineer of the 50s was sort of in a hierarchical organization, kind of narrowly focused technically, and was a category enhancer is the word I would use. So we had televisions, we had automobiles, we had airplanes. And so it was the engineer's job to make those things run faster and jump higher. And that's a respectable thing to do. But now, look at the world that we live in now and look at all the, you look on our desks and all the little gizmos that we use that didn't exist before, all the little applications and software that we have to have that didn't exist a few weeks ago. And so the pace of creating new categories of product and service is fairly stunning. That how new, how much of what we use is. And so where once the premium was on enhancing existing categories of product, now we need category creators. And of course many of the category creators that we lionize in some sense functioned as engineers, but they weren't trained engineers. The Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, are functioned as great category creators, but it's interesting that they weren't actually trained engineers, that they, in order to serve that function, maybe they had to avoid the traditional engineering education of their time.
Do we make distinctions between those kind of newer software type technical achievements and engineering?
Yeah, so I think you can have reasonable debates about that. So there are different takes on it. When I look at computer science, so it's interesting. Computer science called itself computer science. I think that's more an artifact of the post-war myth of engineering the myth that science won the war. So computer science was the first new engineering discipline to emerge post-war. But it chose not to call itself engineering. It chose to call itself a science, not on technical grounds, but in some sense on status grounds. So if you go to Google, all those CS majors are called engineers. They're expected to engineer systems that work, that run faster and jump higher and process more data. So I think you can make some distinctions about the kinds of things they manipulate, but in terms of if you sort of follow a software engineer at Google, say now go to Intel and follow somebody who's doing advanced lithography on some chip, and it's not clear to me that they're doing all that much that's very different in terms of processing and the kind of thinking processes that go into it. So I'm not sure why one would be an engineer and one would be called something else. But you can make there are all kinds of arguments that can be made, and some of the philosophical debates that go on about what is an engineer. There's some interesting writing about that. Michael Davis at IIT has some ideas about when you call someone an engineer when they have an engineering education. So his definitions are largely institutional definitions. That requires that we were talking before about Roman engineers. So a guy like Michael Davis would argue that those weren't engineers. He might call those proto engineers, but because they didn't have something like an engineering education back then that was other than practical or an apprenticeship, that it's not proper to call them engineers. I don't subscribe to that, but you can make arguments like that and support them and write books about them and be philosophy professors about them.
What was the first century equivalent of Abet?
Well, Well, and yeah, so I mean, there is a point to you know, they're fairly early in the, you know, the history of universities. There were law schools, there were medical schools. You know, the Bologna in the 11th century that was founded based on finding some old Roman law in Pisa and starting to teach classes. And so there is a sense in which the university, there were certain professions that were privileged and part of the university, and engineering didn't become part of the university to much, much later. So to that extent, Davis has a point.
So as we move forward and engineers have to have these new skills,
yep,
and applied in new ways.
Yep.
Are there certain characteristics of engineers you think make them effective?
Yeah, I think this, you know, this enhancer, narrow enhancer, categorizer, or category creator distinctions is an interesting one, and I think that the primary difference between them is emotional, not technical. And it goes something like this. The engineer of the 50s needed to be an obedient engineer that followed orders. You're an engineer in this 200 person engineering organization, and your job is to take care of the small piece, and you do that, and it all gets integrated together, and at the out, you know, we get something that comes out the other end. And that's what was, in some ways, what engineering was about then. But now we sort of, we want people that are going to figure out what the next category of product is, or now that we figured out what the category is, to come up with a design that has never been. And so instead of obedience, what we need is someone who's unleashed and confident to sort of, to do that, to take initiative to do something that's never been done. So how do you move from obedient to unleashed? Well, it seems to me that there's, again, it's, first of all, we have to, the recognition that the primary difference is in the emotional variables. And what's the difference between somebody who's obedient? Well, and somebody who's sort of unleashed to be creative. The person, you know, in the 50s, we sort of said, shut up, sit down, learn this stuff, and you'll get a job. And now we want people to start companies and do stuff on their own. So how do you get that? It seems like part of what you've got to do to get somebody to unleash is to trust them. And when you trust them, then they believe they're trusted, and then that belief that they're trusted gives them the courage to overcome their fear to go do something that's never been done, possibly fail, and repeat until something good happens. And so it's that trust, courage, initiative, and something good happening. This, we sometimes call that the unleashing sequence, that is sort of the difference between that engineer who did what he or she was told to the engineer today who's going to do something that's never been done. And I'm not saying that everyone has to do that or that everyone will be a category creator, but it seems like that it's that desire for innovation and creativity and sort of taking chances on stuff that's never been done that's kind of the prime difference between then and now.
What tends to be the biggest problem? Is it the organization trusting the people, or is it the engineers taking the risks?
Yeah, so, and you guys would be better, you know, so my perspectives are largely educational. So in the school setting, it's professors are sort of are a big part of the problem here. A professor is trained to know, right? A professor gets a PhD. A professor in many ways is that expertise. You know, what's an expert? An expert is a person who says, I know. But we're saying we want someone to coach or trust this young person. So we're talking about a shift from I know to I trust in the educational environment. And you guys can say better about, you know, how this plays in organizations. I think in the organizations that get a lot of innovation that are, you know, the, the 3Ms of the world, the Googles, you know, so think about Google, for example, the innovation of giving your engineers a day a week to do what they want. That's in the annals of work history, that's kind of unprecedented, that kind of trust that, okay, well, we'll give you 20% of your paycheck to just do what you think is of interest. That's a kind of trust in the individual to do something that'll be eventually will be valuable to the company. Now, of course, they're not doing it. It's not altruistic. There's a good bit of hope and reason to believe that something good will come from those efforts. But it's much, much different than the command and control kind of mentality that, you know, was in our big vertically horizontally organized corporations back then.
So now we've sort of come full circle. We've gotten back around to why engineering education needs to change.
Yep.
And we were talking earlier, you were talking about iFoundry and some of the work you'd done there. Could you sort of lay out the combination of efforts you have going? Because I know you've got the iFoundry work, you've got Big Beacon,
yep.
Your own consulting firm, 3Joy Consulting,
yep.
And you've also got a book coming out in the near future. Could you talk about how those four aspects of change are sort of working together?
Yeah, and so I continue. You know, so iFoundry was sort of where I got started in trying to do this kind of transformative change in practice, and many of the ideas of the original iFoundry work played out and have formed the basis for going out into the world. The training as a leadership coach was impactful, and so the offerings of 3Joy are things like helping move professors from I know to I trust. How do we change universities at both a personal level, and how do we take the kinds of things that industry has learned about change management and organizational development and get universities to adopt those practices to help move their systems so that they're that they can actually make changes. So 3Joy is about helping individual universities, colleges of engineering, colleges of technology help make those moves. And then the Big Beacon is a nonprofit that was formed last year to help bring together like-minded people who would like to share best practices with one another, support each other as they're making change, and sort of collaboratively disrupt the system. So the Big Beacon is in some sense a social movement of the willing that are trying to make these changes to kind of get them together. And then finally, the book that I'm working on with my co-author, Mark Somerville, who is associate dean at Olin College, which is a relatively new engineering program that embodies many of the things that we're talking about. So we're working on a book called A Whole New Engineer, A Surprising Emotional Journey, that sort of talks about the experiences that Olin College had and its founding and iFoundry had in trying to make change, and what was common and different in those, and what we think that means in terms of the kind of environment you need to create to help educate the engineer of the future. And so that book's coming out early next year, and we'll be going on a global book tour, not a book tour for book tour's sake, but a book tour to have a conversation about what engineering education needs to be.
And so have you planned out yet where that book tour is going to go?
Well, we're working on, yeah, no, the short answer to that question is no, but we know that there'll be a whistle stop at Olin, and there'll be a whistle stop at Illinois, and then we're looking for folks around the world to tell us where we should come and whether they want to engage in this conversation. And we expect to there's a fair amount of interest in engineering education reform in South America and Brazil and in Chile, for example, and in Asia and Singapore and Australia. Well, that side of the world anyways, and we're expecting to visit many universities, to visit many cities that have concentrated engineering populations, and not just educationally, but companies and professional societies and others who think that engineering education reform and transformation are important, and to have a conversation about what, you know, we put these ideas out there. We know that to a certain extent and to a certain audience, they're fairly controversial to be talking about things like trust and courage in place of technical subjects is maybe heretical in some ways, but we think it's a conversation that needs to be had, and we value differences of opinion and value the learning that'll come out of the conversation that we hope will occur.
If you come by Raleigh, I'll buy you a beer.
All right. So we'd be happy to, and there's a nice, concentration of engineering talent there. And yeah, we think that, you know, places like that are a good place for us to come by and have both good, there are plenty of engineering programs in the area and then lots of engineering talent in the area. That's sort of the perfect kind of place to make a stop.
Yeah, for those that aren't aware, Raleigh has what's called Research Triangle Park, which is a big collection of tech companies between Raleigh and Durham, where my offices are located, actually.
Yeah, so I think, you know, places like Raleigh, Silicon Valley, there's some natural places to think about going to. But then, you know, for those where we're happy to come to smaller schools that are intent on making changes, talking about sharing some of the firsthand stories of the ways in which young people get when you teach engineering in this sort of passionate way that ties in directly to sort of unleashing and gaining confidence in this way, it's really cool to see young people who might not have been engineers grab onto it and get it and then embrace it and then go on and do the thing, you know, do the heavy lifting that is required to become a good engineer.
Mm-hmm. My old professor back where I went to school in Rochester, New York, we were talking about before engineers in the 30s and the 40s and everything before World War II ended, you know, focusing on making things. And he kind of instituted a new course right before I left school to teach, you know, those basics again in terms of electrical engineering, you know, how to actually produce a good PCB and solder and cover those little esoteric topics that you have to deal with on a daily basis, but most of your classes will never cover.
Yep.
It was getting actually pretty good results. You know, it seemed like their kids enjoyed, you know, having that hands-on activity brought back in and actually seeing the results of their labor and not just a graph pop up in the simulator.
Yep. No, it's, I think there progress has been made and that these efforts are starting to pay off. We're seeing it in K-12 with things like the FIRST Robotics and the Project Lead the Way curricula, with hands-on learning for young people, getting them excited about engineering. Of course, we've got a bit of a pipeline problem. We get them excited about that, and then we throw them into the math science death march, and we crush them, and then they lose interest, and then they go into psychology.
So do you have any advice for someone who has made it through that math science death march and now wants to become a better engineer after having departed university?
You know, so I think we're all survivors of that process, and I think there's a certain sense of you get through that, and in all social systems there are rites of passage. So I think that making it through the math science death march is an important rite of passage that we share as engineers. And, you know, whenever, you know, people try to get rid of various rites of passage, trying to get rid of fraternity hazing doesn't work. There are, you know, culturally, there are just, you know, there are rites of passage everywhere. It's sort of an anthropological fact of life. I think one of the things is that, you know, that we're part of what's happening is that we sort of we're reframing those rites of passage back to things like design, and it's less about the math and science, which are important instruments of engineering, but they're not engineering. To do math and science is not to be an engineer. To to make cool stuff for people. That's engineering. And oh yes, by the way, sometimes we use math and science. And so the design as a rite of passage seems like a better place to go. But I'm sort of diverting from the question a little bit. But so those of us who went through that, you know, our educations were this fairly narrow and technical one. So what do we do about that? Well, it seems to me that engineers that are surviving in real organizational settings have either get or figure out many of the skills that they need in the workforce. Many will go on and will sort of bolster the technical skills with the business skills of an MBA. Many companies have organizational and leadership development of various kinds, and so you get the rounding there. There are ways to get it. I'd say some of what we're working on now that might not be contained in those experiences, in the MBA experience or the org training kind of thing, are some of these deeper coaching and collaborative skills. The sort of so how do we listen to it and listening more deeply to the other person from that person's perspective, not our own perspective. And there's this work that's come out of Google on mindfulness in the workplace that's starting to get some play. And much of what we're working on and trying to transform engineering education involves things like my awareness and noticing and listening and questioning. And so in many ways, there are many people now talking about these deeper skills of self-awareness, noticing your own thoughts and feelings and the thoughts and feelings of others around you. Sometimes this comes under the rubric of emotional intelligence, being a better listener or better. I like to use the term, you know, so we use the term soft skills to say what it is that engineers need once they, you know, when they come out of a narrow technical education. I like to say, but by using the term soft, it's like they're not as crisp as our technical skills. And I like to use the term sharp soft skills. It seems to me that one of the things I learned in coaching is that done right, there's a rigor to communication. There's a rigor to listening. There's a rigor to self-awareness that you can bring, where these things become less fuzzy and sort of arts and flowery, and more something that looks like an engineering tool that can be used with some precision and some reliability and some repeatability. So I think there are like the Google mindfulness. And I just noticed that there's now like a national tour of kind of the mindfulness skills for technical workers. I think stuff like that could be helpful to the engineer trained in the old way.
Right. So Dave, we've rolled well past the hour mark, so we should probably be thinking about wrapping this up and letting you get some sleep. So maybe if I just finish up, you were talking now about some of the skills, the listening skills. In fact, that question that I asked Carmen at the beginning of this episode,
yep,
noticing, listening, and questioning, that was actually a course that you incorporated, I believe, into the iFoundry program at the University of Illinois, was it not?
Yeah, so the noticing, listening, and questioning, we've done it at iFoundry, we've done it in Singapore, we've done it in Italy, we do it with professors, we do it with students. It's fairly universal and has a surprising impact on people's interpersonal skill in a short time.
Yeah, and so if I understand correctly, you started incorporating these types of courses into the engineering program at University of Illinois in 2009, which would make the first graduates be coming out this year in 2013.
Yeah.
So what's the early story? You've got these efforts. You make this pitch through Big Beacon. You're writing the book.
Yeah.
Is it to these students? Is it making a difference?
It appears to. Yeah. So some of the early results from iFoundry are, and I don't have the detailed statistics in front of me, but that the work that we did in iFoundry had a positive effect on engineering retention, which is, you know, typically been abysmal, and there was an improvement in retention statistics. That original cohort were sort of gatherings, were in the data gathering process, and I'll know better here in a month or two what the summary statistics were on that initial cohort, what they ended up doing, how many of them survived. But sort of the qualitative story is things looked up when you look at, say, what happened. There's a better track record over a longer period of time, with better data at Olin College, and the reports from the work, from the workplace, is that those kids are project ready, and they're good project managers on day one and good project team members on day one. So that the year to 18 months that it usually takes for a fresh grad to kind of get up to speed is cut down to maybe 3-4 months. And, by major employers like Google and Microsoft. So the news, the early return, it's not definitive, but the early returns are good, that these things are sort of pointing in an interesting direction.
Fantastic. Well, we should let you go. If people that are listening wish to get a hold of you, if they want to say, come to our area to talk during your book tour, or B, they just want to get more information, or they want to contact you, what's sure. the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, so I think probably the best way is to just send me an email at DEG, my initials, Delta Echo Golf, at 3joy.com.
Okay, so they can also follow you, I believe, on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at DEG511. And likewise on Facebook, and Big Beacon is on Twitter at Big Beacon, and it's on Facebook at Big Beacon.
Well, Dave, thank you so very much for being a guest here on the Engineering Commons.
My pleasure, and I really appreciate. I'm grateful for you guys putting on this program. It's a great service to the engineering community. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
All right. We'll let you go. Have a great evening.
Okay. Thanks.
Take it easy, Dave.
See you, Dave.
Good night.
The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.